At last week's Parliamentary Select Committee hearings, James Murdoch fell silent when Adrian Sanders MP asked him whether he was familiar with the term willful blindness. Here is that moment.
And finally, are you familiar with the term willful blindness?
Mr. Sanders, would you care to elaborate?
It is a term that came up in the Enron scandal, and willful blindness is a legal term. It states that if there is knowledge that you could have had and should have had but chose not to have, you are still responsible.
Mr. Sanders, do you have a question? Respectfully, I don't know what you'd like me to say.
Whether you were aware...
I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of that particular phrase.
But now you are familiar with the term because I've explained it to you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would have thought that what they demonstrated was willful deafness, but it's something. Okay, tonight we're going to look into the idea of willful blindness with the author of a new book on the subject. As I said, I've written newspaper columns about it. Now there's a book, and it's from Margaret Heffernan, who's a former BBC producer and a former CEO of an internet outsourcing company called CMGI. Margaret is visiting professor and entrepreneur in residence. How about that? At the University of Bath, and among other journalistic gigs, she's a regular columnist for the Huffington Post, which, and I should remind you, has announced that it is going to start up in Australia. She says that whenever there's a major institutional calamity, Enron was mentioned, Abu Ghraib, Lehman Brothers, the recent BP oil rig disaster, the arguments are always pretty much the same. What we heard from the Murdochs is what we always hear. A few bad apples, nobody at the top is to blame. I remember Ralph Nader, when Barry Jones brought into Australia decades ago, made the point that when he went to Detroit with the horror stories of what was happening with the US car, no one knew anything. He could go right up and down the entire corporate chain, and he was surrounded by willful blindness. Margaret joined us on The Blower from New York. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Thanks very much, and thanks for such a wonderful introduction.
Margaret, I wasn't aware that willful blindness was a legal term. Explain what it is legally.
Yes, it was used in the Enron trial when Kenneth Lay and Jeff Skilling were put on trial. And essentially what it said is that, if you can demonstrate that the necessary information was available at the time, so we're not talking about hindsight here. If you can demonstrate that the information you needed, was available, and so you could have known it, and that it was part of your job to understand what was going on, so you should have known it, then the law should treat you as though you did know it. And I came across it because I wrote two plays about Enron for the BBC, and I read the transcript of this trial. And at the time that I was writing those plays, the banks were collapsing, and lots of bank leaders were saying, oh, my goodness, we had no idea. And I remember thinking, oh, don't be ridiculous. How could you possibly not have seen the dangers here?
Margaret, suddenly so another organization comes to mind, and that's the Vatican, not knowing or claiming not to know
about
what was going on with the pedophile scandal.
Absolutely, and there's a long section in my book about that, and, because there is willful blindness on many levels, both at the level of the Vatican, definitely at the level of the Irish state, which felt very beholden to the church as the major power in the land, in Ireland. So they turned a blind eye to what was going on, and so did many, many ordinary people. I remember, being in Ireland in the 80s and 90s, and people knew, don't send your son to confirmation lessons with that priest on his own. Don't let your child stay after school with that priest on his own. So there was willful blindness really at every level of society.
One of the things that worries me most, Margaret, is that there is willful blindness amongst newspaper readers, television viewers, radio listeners, who choose not to know the other side of a major issue. They just cling to a little pile of prejudice, be it about climate change or, as I said before in the Australian context, refugees. So you're right, it's right up and down, isn't it? From the top to the bottom.
Well, it's right up and down. And I think, you know, the thing that I came to understand as I was writing the book is that one reason it's so persistent and so prevalent is because it makes us feel safer. You know, we cuddle up to our cherished beliefs and our preferred view of the world, and we, you know, blind ourselves to anything that challenges that. And for a time, that feels just great. And it's only when it all falls apart that we look back and think, oh my goodness, how could I have been so blind? But I think the central irony in willful blindness is that it makes us feel really comfortable and safe at exactly the moment that we're at greatest risk.
And what happens when a corporation, for example, invents what you describe as face-saving fictions is it makes the final catastrophe all the worse.
That's right, because all you're really doing is delaying the evil day. You know, the longer you persist with those fantasies, the higher the cost becomes. And so you saw this in the banking, you know, collapse, so that the longer this insane sale of inappropriate mortgages persisted, the higher the debt on all the banks' balance sheets became. So the longer you stay blind, the greater the cost is bound to be.
I like the way you democratize the phenomenon in the way that I have been suggesting. You talk about people who run up big credit card debts or willfully blind, people who smoke when they know they really shouldn't, child abuse that happens within families, not simply within the Catholic Church. And it happens hugely in medicine, doesn't it?
It happens hugely in medicine, and I think, you know, it's easy to think, oh, willful blindness is just a fancy word for greed. But I think what's so interesting when you study it in the medical establishment is that it's very driven by hierarchy. You know, there's this really interesting phenomenon that shows that medical students, when they begin their education, are pretty conservative, pretty likely to toe the line. But by the time they've finished their medical education, they are more likely to do that. So they've absorbed what's called the hidden curriculum, this message that, you know, if you want to be a successful doctor or nurse, you know, you're not going to challenge, you're not going to doubt, you're going to go with the flow, you're going to stick with your team. And, of course, from a patient perspective, this is really very worrying. You know, you have in Australia a fantastic doctor, Steve Bolton, who was the only person at a huge hospital in Bristol in England to keep questioning the fact that such a large number of babies were dying in heart operations. Yeah. You know, everybody knew what was going on. Everybody knew they had a very dangerous surgeon on their hands. And he was the only person who was prepared to keep challenging it to the point that it was exposed.
Margaret, I don't know whether you've observed this at any point in your career with the great public broadcaster in Britain, but I have to tell you that I've observed over the years a variation on willful blindness, which is self-censorship. No one tells anyone that they should take this line or that they should go easy in that area. People just get it. They just do it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But I think what's also interesting is that very often, you know, when everything falls apart, many people will acknowledge, you know, that they did have this little voice at the back of their heads that said, ooh, I'm not so sure about this, which they chose not to listen to. I mean, in your words, you know, self-censorship. So there is this sort of dim awareness that actually we're going into dangerous territory here, but we choose not to listen to it. And I think, you know, if there's any kind of moral to my book, it's that when you hear that distant voice, it really behooves you to pay attention.
Margaret, because there's a lot of morals in your book. Let's look at, pick up on what you're just talking about and tell the listener about the people you call Cassandras.
Right, so, you know, I was very interested that there are people who seem to see things that others don't. And I wondered, you know, was there any kind of unifying characteristic Cassandra, of course, is the Greek goddess who was given the gift of prophecy, but then because she spurned Apollo's advances, was also given the painful punishment of never being believed. And so you have a large number of people who do manage not to be willfully blind, and of course they're often rejected and certainly not listened to. And there's a lot of mythology around these people, which is, you know, that whistleblowers, for example, are more likely to be women than men, which is not true. That they're more likely to be people of faith, which is not true. But and so I kept trying to see, you know, is there anything we can learn from them? And I guess I came up with a couple of things. One is they're certainly very detail-oriented. So they're working from the facts rather than from a desirable belief. They're very good at seeing multiple perspectives. There's a fantastic advertising executive I interviewed who refused to do work with Enron at a time that everybody was beating a path to its door. Mm. And he told me this great story about pushing his sister to school. She was she had spina bifida. And he said he saw everybody looking at them and feeling so sorry for them. And he thought, you know, he just had this wonderful, very rich relationship with his sister. And he thought, you know, if they are missing so much about us, what am I missing about them? Now, that's a really interesting question for a schoolboy to be asking.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it gave him a kind of habit of mind, which is looking at anything to ask himself the question, what am I missing here? You know, he just learned very early on that face value wasn't very valuable.
Margaret, you talk about the essential ordinariness. In fact, quite often, on all the sounds, well, it's wrong, but a spectacular degree of ordinariness amongst your Cassandras. That they,
yeah.
That what makes them different is that they somehow see what the people around them didn't want to see. It's essentially a pretty simple phenomenon in that sense.
It is, and I think, you know, it's comforting to know that these people don't have spectacularly high IQs, you know, they don't come from really remarkable backgrounds. I think, you know, they are good at pattern recognition, that's certainly the case. They do have a sort of mental test for things, which is, you know, how does this play out for the least powerful people involved, which is, again, another great question. But I think what Cassandras show us in their very ordinariness is that if they can do it, we can do it. It's partly a question of, you know, taking seriously that voice at the back of your head.
But Margaret, often when someone finds the courage to say it, they are crushed, they are ignored, and they are not listened to. There was the odd voice like this within Enron. There was certainly a very brave woman in the Bush administration, and perhaps it was Clinton, mm-hmm. who spoke out against the nonsensical sort of worldview of Alan Greenspan. But they tend to come croppers. Very few of them, you know, soar like phoenix out of the ashes of others. It's a tough thing to take on.
It is a tough thing to take on, but I would say a couple of things. One is, I think the idea that you're going to be absolutely crushed becomes a sort of self-fulfilling fantasy. It gives us all the excuse not to do anything. So I'm skeptical of it.
Okay, I shall withdraw the suggestion.
But I think the other thing is that, you know, many of the Cassandras I interviewed found that in challenging, you know, the central fiction, whatever it was, whether it was, you know, the Catholic Church or whether it was the way that the army was dealing with veterans from the Iraq War, that in challenging these things, they really found their life's mission. They found something that could make them intensely proud of themselves and that stretched them way beyond anything they knew they were capable of.
Well, Deep Throat comes to mind, doesn't he? You know, this FBI guy who brought down Nixon finally with the help of a couple of young journalists.
That's right. And there's also this fabulous woman in my book named Gayla Benfield who took 25 years to prove conclusively that people in her town were being poisoned with asbestos. Now, she's a heroic, heroic figure. But, you know, there's nothing special about her, and she didn't know. At no point in her life did she realize, you know, that her her mission in life, in a way, would be to save the lives of thousands of people. And however hard that was for her, today, of course, she is so much richer because she did it.
Margaret, was there a Cassandra within the Bernie Madoff corporation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was this fantastic financial analyst, Harry Markopoulos, and he initially studied Madoff's investment patterns because he wanted to copy them. You know, so this is not a crusader by any stretch of the imagination. He just thought, wow, this guy's doing really good, really great work. I wonder if I can figure out his secret and copy it. And, of course, as he says, you know, he took one look at some of the numbers and knew there was something wrong. I mean, he's obviously, you know, very gifted in the math department, but he just knew it couldn't be true, that the statistical similarities and patterns were just implausible. And it, you know, it took years, and he kept writing to the SEC and saying, you know, you need to investigate this, it has to be fraud. And nobody really wanted to take Madoff on, and the SEC really didn't have the people they needed with the skills and qualifications to understand what was wrong with the numbers.
Margaret, you make a fascinating... Sorry, you make a fascinating...
For years.
I'm sorry about interrupting, but I've got to move it on. But you made an observation about the Madoff situation, that it was an affinity crime, that he preyed on people like himself who knew other people like themselves, none of whom asked hard questions because their level of comfort with each other was so high.
That's right, and it's something we all do. You know, if I move into a new neighborhood, I'm very likely to ask people like myself, you know, where do they send their kids to school? You know, where's the best place to go out for dinner? You know, we take those kinds of shortcuts all the time. And what was clear in the Madoff case is that it isn't so much that people trusted Madoff, because most of them never met Madoff. But they trusted the people who trusted the people who trusted the people who trusted Madoff. And because they were all very similar, they kind of blinded themselves to any kind of serious questioning and just thought, well, if people like me think it's okay, then it must be okay.
Alan Greenspan, devotee of Ayn Rand, was he willfully blind or just so ideologically driven that he wouldn't listen to anyone?
Well, I think his ideology blinded him entirely. What's so incredible about Greenspan is even after the banks collapsed, and even though with hindsight many, many people could see that there'd been 14 years of warning signs, even then he said, you know, I don't accept the system wasn't working because, okay, it may have failed now, but until now it had been fine. Well, I mean, there's masses of evidence that until the banks collapsed, lots of things hadn't been fine. But, you know, Greenspan's ideology and his fervent belief in Ayn Rand blinded him to masses of data. I mean, he describes Rand as the stabilizing force in his life. You know, you clearly feel with Greenspan that if you took his ideology away, there would be nobody left.
There is one Australian who was an absolute devotee of Ayn Rand, and that was one of our Prime Ministers, Malcolm Fraser. You will be interested or perhaps amused to know, Margaret, that he has gradually evolved into a stalwart of the hard left. He's probably the most left-wing politician in Australia these days, although, sad to say, of course, he's well and truly out of power. But Greenspan, to me, is probably the towering figure that you write about.
Well, I think the blindness of Greenspan is epic in its proportions. And the degree to which he persuaded, you know, the most mighty people in America to believe in him, when, you know, his track record as an economist, as an academic economist, is almost non-existent, is just remarkable. And again, you have this kind of domino effect that, you know, Greenspan believed in Rand. People believed, you know, the president believed in Greenspan. People believed in the president. You know, and so at every level, people were not asking serious questions, when you had these regular explosions in the derivatives market.
So it's not the blind leading the blind, it's the willfully blind leading the willfully blind.
Margaret, that's absolutely right.
Thank you for your time. Margaret Heffernan's book, Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril, published by Simon and Schuster. Well, that's pretty much the program. And for more information on this little wireless show, you can visit our website, abc.net.au/rn, Late Night Live. And incidentally, I see today that there's almost 1,000 lovely messages for my 20th year. Makes me get very, very weepy. On our next, the story of an Israeli pediatrician and a Palestinian mother trying to get treatment for her baby. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. Don't be willfully blind, and we'll see you later.